I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of February. All things political this hour, and life really is all things political these weeks. Ruth Conniff is joining us, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. First, many thanks to the ever-so-capable and erudite John Munson for filling in for me last week while I swam in the ocean and read Marilynne Robinson. She's so good. I'm going to read it again. I'm going to read the book again. She is so good. Well, I did manage to follow the Iowa caucus and the Clinton-Sanders debate, but do have some political news gaps returning to Milwaukee, so help me fill those in during this hour. We have a lot to talk about with the New Hampshire primary tomorrow. Ruth has written extensively about Hillary, Bernie, and the progressive question. What does it mean to be a Democratic socialist? We'll ask that question. Is Hillary the establishment candidate? What kind of impact is the Sanders grassroots populist movement having on Democratic policy? Marco Rubio's rocky debate, repeating himself four times. It really was bizarre, wasn't it? Barack Obama, the first president who wants to change the country, not fix it, and he repeated it over and over. Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem made some comments over the weekend. Madeleine Albright, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. They are campaigning for Hillary Clinton. And we will talk about other issues, but mostly it's about the primary and what's going on politically. Ruth has been with us before. Ruth is editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. She's a native of Madison, Wisconsin, and she began working at the magazine when she was hired as a summer intern after her sophomore year at Yale. She has been on many media outlets, and we're delighted to have her with us and welcome phone calls, as we always do. What are your thoughts on the questions I asked at the top of the hour? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Ruth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you, Kathleen.
Yeah. Well, it really does seem like it's constant now. I say it seems like all I do is watch debates and town hall meetings and read about what's going on. We're in the thick of this. Let's start with this definition of democratic socialism. David K. Johnston wrote a piece recently saying that substantial majorities of all of us are democratic socialists and Republicans, actually. Many of them might consider themselves democratic socialists. What does that phrase mean?
I think it means that you believe that there's a positive role for government, that we don't live in a sort of the extreme libertarian live and let die kind of society where you, if you can afford to pay for basic services, you're lucky, and if you can't, good luck to you. And I think it was the most, interestingly, the most Googled word of 2015,
right.
I think, thanks to Bernie Sanders. There's a whole generation of people who don't have the Cold War aversion to the word socialism. There's a new generation of young people who are facing staggering college debt and who see a role for the public sphere in just lifting the floor, which I think is fundamentally what that ideal is about. It's about the kind of society that we see in Western Europe where people can afford to go to college, where you're not sort of faced with this terrifying prospect of the declining middle class that we've been looking at here for 40 years in the United States, where you have a sense of security for the entire population. And it comes at the expense of taxes on the very, very wealthy. And that's something that Bernie Sanders talks a lot about that has been anathema since the Reagan administration in some ways in American politics, not just for Republicans, but for Democrats. And that's changing because conditions are changing, because our economy has become so unequal that I think there are a lot of people who are taking a look at the idea of, having Eisenhower-era taxes restored on the very, very wealthy and having college affordable for people and a floor under people so that, we don't face this tremendous economic anxiety.
Mm-hmm. The debate last week between Sanders and Clinton, a lot of time was spent and a lot has been written about who is progressive and what progressive means and whether or not she is the establishment candidate. Is she an establishment candidate, and is that a bad thing?
Well, you know, Hillary said in the debate, how could only Bernie Sanders could call her the establishment candidate because she's running to be the first woman president of the United States. And that has a very strong appeal to a lot of women, women like you mentioned in the intro, Gloria Steinem and Madeleine Albright, women of Hillary's generation who really see it as a feminist cause to get a woman in office in the White House, and that that is an establishment-breaking precedent. However, Hillary Clinton's been in politics for a long, long time. And her ties to Wall Street, which is something that Bernie Sanders brings up a lot and is a big liability for her with the Occupy generation, you know, the sense that she is very much an insider in Washington, has been there for many years, including the 8 years of her husband's administration, has advocated for establishment-friendly policies, including NAFTA, welfare reform, you know, deregulation of the banks. She doesn't want to restore the Glass-Steagall law that separates investment banking from regulation. Banking. I mean, this is a person who really is an insider and really is a part of the establishment. And I think in that sense, it's absolutely fair to call her the establishment candidate.
The comments by Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem were really something. Madeleine Albright and Hillary was laughing about this. There's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other. That's pretty strong language from Albright.
I think that that is just an incredible political misstep.
I do too.
Because fundamentally, you have these older women telling younger women who are voting in droves for Bernie Sanders that they need to shape up. And it's a scolding message. And it's, you know, not, I mean, it compounds the problem that Hillary Clinton has, which is that she's not inspiring young voters. Now she's not inspiring them and she's giving them a kick in the pants. I mean, right. I don't see this as an improvement.
Yeah. And Steinem's comment suggesting that women were backing Sanders so they could meet the boys. They go where the boys are.
Unbelievable. I mean, that is really like old line sexism, right? I mean, this is really, it's belittling and diminishing of young women who, you know, are part of this, what I think is a huge surprise, including to the Sanders campaign itself, this movement for Bernie Sanders as representing the aspirations of younger voters. And I think that Hillary Clinton's challenge in trying to beat Sanders is to appeal to those young voters and understand what their aspirations are, not to scold them and tell them, A, you're never going to get what you want, it's not going to happen, and B, you're a traitor if you don't support me.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about these figures. 64% of women under 45 supporting Sanders, women over 45 backing Clinton by 9 percentage points. But 64% under 45 supporting Sanders. What's behind that, Ruth?
You know, I mean, I think this is something that we saw developing with the huge groundswell of support for Elizabeth Warren. And we did a piece in The Progressive back in March of 2014 about young voters. Our writer, Abby Scheer, went around the country and interviewed young women, young feminist voters. And the title of the piece was Not Ready for Hillary. They were not enthusiastic about a Hillary Clinton prospective candidacy. But the person they were really excited for was Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason is that young people are facing a very serious economic situation, including massive college debt, and the sense that Wall Street is getting away with murder, crashed the economy, was bailed out by taxpayers, and that the prospects for a secure job are shrinking. So, you know, there is an awful large number of young people, including young women, who feel like those are key issues and they want to hear those issues addressed, and also feel that politics as usual, including Democratic Party politics, has not served them adequately, that they are just not seeing the kinds of fundamental progressive change that they wanted to see out of the Obama administration and that they, you know, hope for their own futures.
You, in a recent piece, wrote about progressives who may support Hillary, saying she's the sensible choice for anyone who doesn't want to risk a Cruz administration, highly qualified and smart. Not, these aren't what you think necessarily. It would be people who would make the case, the progressive case for her. Is that true, that people are risking a Cruz administration, although we don't know what's going to happen there, really, either? And she is highly qualified and she is highly smart, and that's pretty good.
You know, I mean, I think it's up to individual voters to decide whether they are voting strategically or they're voting out of idealism and hope for something bigger. But here's what I think. I think that the folks who are writing columns for the Washington Post and the New York Times and New York Magazine, many liberal pundits are saying these Bernie Sanders voters are crazy. They've got to be stopped. We've all got to fold into the Hillary campaign. It's just not going to make any difference because that's not what influences voters. And when you see the outpouring for Sanders, what you see is an outpouring for a very progressive, very optimistic message about what the United States could be, that we could join the rest of the industrialized world in providing health care to people as a right, that we could actually afford free college, that, you know, when you have huge corporations not paying any taxes at all, it's simply not true that we don't have the money to have a more secure environment and a larger middle class. It's just that we have this, you know, tremendous wealth and influence at the top that has, you know, it's turning us into Argentina. So, you know, that message is going to have tremendous resonance. And with the Sanders campaign, what's interesting about the Sanders campaign to me as the editor of the Progressive magazine is the way it's pulling together movement people and young voters who are really idealistic to push for these changes that ultimately are necessary if we're going to have a progressive future. Now, that doesn't mean that he's the best candidate for this election in 2016, but I don't think that voters are going to make their decisions necessarily on that very strategic basis. And so I don't think that there's this huge conflict between being interested in that movement and, you know, what happens in 2016. I think it's going to happen whether people like it or not. That's really where the energy is on the progressive side. And that's a good thing because in the long run, you know, we need somebody to make those points, and we need these movements to knit themselves together and push for a better country.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you saw Maureen Dowd's column yesterday, which was really an attack on Hillary, but also not positive things to say about Bernie Sanders. Let me quote a bit to you and see what your response is. She's running against a grumpy Gramps, and he has a brusque manner and a shaking grasp of world affairs, but he gets her on this giving three speeches to Goldman Sachs for $675,000. And, well, that's what they were paying, which was a bizarre response on her part because she usually is very prepared to deal with most attacks. Is that a fair description of him? He's a kind of a grumpy Gramps and got a brusque manner and he has no grasp of world affairs.
Well, he's not running on charisma, you know, and that's part of what's fascinating outpouring for him, right? Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like there's a lot of young Ruth Bader Ginsburg fans, who created this meme, the notorious RBG. I mean, he's so unhip, he's hip to younger voters. Yeah. But I think, you know, what Maureen Dowd was talking about in that column is that, okay, Hillary, when she was running in 2008 and Obama ran over her, you know, I think Maureen Dowd used the phrase the tulip craze for Obama. Like, there was no stopping this guy. It was a phenomenon. It was amazing. It was the first African-American president. But now she poured money. She poured manpower into Iowa. I went to Iowa and watched some of this.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And the result of all that effort is a tie with a guy who was laughed at when he got in the race, whose poll numbers were nil a year ago. So, you know, that is not a sign of strength for Hillary Clinton. I think that is absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. She also made some reference to Bill Clinton, and he stepped up things, I guess, a little bit today in New Hampshire, but he does seem to be kind of worn out in the background, doesn't he? He doesn't seem to be full of vigor and a real effective campaigner on her behalf.
I don't know what's going on with that. Yeah, he seemed very quiet, and he was standing behind her with a kind of zoned out expression on his face during her speech in Iowa. And he is one of the most talented politicians of our lifetime, and I don't know whether it's a strategic choice for him not to overshadow her by pouring it on, or whether, you know, he is exhausted. I don't know.
Marco Rubio's performance, I didn't get to see the whole debate. I was flying, actually, so I couldn't see it. But I did see this clip, and I was just astounded. Marco Rubio's debate on Saturday, he did repeat himself. It was bizarre, four times. I read somewhere that the prompter wasn't working, and so he just went into whatever was on the prompter. But this Barack Obama is the first president, at least in my lifetime, who wants to change the country, not fix its problems. Four times in a row. It was bizarre.
It was a disaster for him.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a disaster. I mean, unfortunately for him, it confirmed the exact liability that the other candidates are pointing out, that he's young, he's untested, and he seems to be an empty suit. So, you know, the fact that he kept saying the same things over and over, and then the candidates were piling on, especially Chris Christie, it was really... It was a bad moment for him. On the other hand, it was Saturday night before the Super Bowl. You know, he may live through that just fine.
It did appear, and I'm wondering if you make anything. Right after Iowa, everybody was saying, well, he came in third, and he acted like he gave a victory speech. Do people in the press, mainstream press for the most part, just glom onto a candidate because he's doing better than they thought? And there are some people who think he would run the best among all the Republican candidates. And so the focus was on him big time. Going into New Hampshire, does that performance upset his chances tomorrow, do you think, or not?
It might. It might among people who are really paying close attention. I think, you know, how many voters are paying really close attention to debate performances? I mean, in New Hampshire, people notoriously can't make up their mind until the last minute, so maybe a Saturday night poor debate performance matters. And I think the mainstream press was excited about Rubio because everybody's been waiting for him to be the sane alternative to Cruz and Trump. And so, oddly, his third-place finish was treated as this victory, and Cruz grumbled about it a lot. But I think Cruz and Trump are discounted as too disliked, too extreme, too outside the mainstream of the party to be the real candidate. And so there is this kind of thumb on the scale by the media, like the Republican Party establishment, sort of waiting for the real candidate to emerge, and people are waiting for that to be Rubio.
We're going to welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political for this Monday. Day before the New Hampshire primary, Ruth Conniff is our guest, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. She's written extensively about this year's election cycle, and we focused a little bit because she has followed Hillary, Bernie, and the progressive question pretty extensively, and so much has been written lately about whether or not Hillary Clinton is progressive. Is she using her gender? Because she's making a lot of reference to the fact that she would be the first female president, something she didn't do very much in 2008, but she's doing it quite a bit right now. And that's something that we wonder what you think about that. Is that a good way for her to go? Could a democratic socialist, do most of us identify ourselves as democratic socialists or not? Do we think of ourselves as highly conservative? How do we label ourselves? Or are labels rather meaningless? What do you make of, and do you think it will harm him at all, Marco Rubio? I thought months ago that he would be the candidate the Republicans would be best to have at the head of the ticket because he'd probably stand the best chance after seeing Saturday. I don't know about that anymore, but as Ruth said, it was the day before the Super Bowl, and how many people were really paying attention to that, except perhaps people who live in New Hampshire. Well, join us, would you please? Here's our phone number, and lines are open for you at this very moment, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we love to read your messages always, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. To you in just a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ruth Conniff is our guest for All Things Political. We're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Mike in Plymouth. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Well, I consider Bernie Sanders the Pope Francis. I think the phenomenon that we've seen with a gentler, kindler Pope has actually opened up the door for Bernie, and I think it's an opportunity that he projects the same kind of gentleness and openness and non-political that I think attracts a lot of people. My other comments are, I think, as a recovering Democrat, I think Bill Clinton was the best Republican president that Democrats ever elected. And in the end, I think, this is going to sound bold, but I think Jeb Bush is going to come through the flames.
Once really?
Once the top three people are done beating themselves to a pulp, Trump is going to go independent, Cruz and Rubio and whoever else are going to knock themselves silly, and Jeb's going to come in the flames with all the money in the world. He's going to be boring as heck, but I think it's going to be Jeb Bush in the end.
Ruth, what do you think?
Very interesting.
Yes,
I think those are all really interesting comments.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows what's going to happen with this Republican field? I think if Jeb Bush doesn't win, it will show that you can spend $1 billion and still not win elected office, which is the bright side of that campaign. He's taken such a beating, and he's not doing really well, and I don't know whether he'll emerge. The Trump phenomenon, I think, is fascinating, and I think it's beginning to fade. You saw it begin to fade in Iowa. And so I think that, in fact, it's not going to turn out that Trump emerges. And I somehow doubt that he'll run as an independent. I get the feeling that he's getting tired of this. I saw him in Iowa. I saw nobody introduce him in Iowa. He didn't really have much of a ground operation. He didn't have many Iowans working for him. He had Sarah Palin introduce him, and he had his daughter running the caucus in the same hotel ballroom where I saw him hold a rally. And I think that, you know, sort of air campaign that he's been running with this tremendous outpouring he's gotten and this phenomenon that he's been is coming to an end. And I think that's my prediction. On the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton thing, I agree. I think there is something very compelling about some of the points that Sanders makes, and they are sort of Pope Francis-like. And the example that came to mind when you were saying that is the death penalty question at the Democratic debate, when Hillary Clinton supported the death penalty in certain cases. And Bernie Sanders made a very clear statement about opposing, you know, there's too much killing in society, and the government shouldn't be part of the killing. It's just that very simple, clear moral statement that mm-hmm. I think is very appealing to people.
And it's so unusual, isn't it? There's something just remarkable about his very presence, you know, with people make a lot of the hair and the kind of rumpled look. But there is something so authentic about him that it is refreshing with everybody else who's so polished and has talking points. Not that he doesn't. He's got the same thing that he says over and over and over. I wish he would broaden it just a little bit. But there's nothing that's phony about him.
Right. I think he's not a career politician, no. And he doesn't have to become president of the United States. It's not his turn. He doesn't have everything riding on. You know, it's a, and I think, frankly, that's what this political year is all about. You know, that's part of the appeal of Donald Trump as well. I mean, you see people really responding to somebody who gets outside of this very stage-managed political message machine that we've all gotten used to and distrust, frankly.
Let's go to Michael in Mirabel. Thank you so much, Mike, for your call. It was a good one. Michael in Mirabel, hi.
Yes, good morning to you. Or I guess it's good afternoon.
It is, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
A couple of points. So Sanders, I don't know if I'd call him Democratic Socialist. He's definitely a socialist, which I support. But there's no way that Hillary Clinton, in my estimation, could be identified as being progressive. I mean, she's very much pro-military, pro-death penalty. She does not focus on the issue of income maldistribution or wealth maldistribution. She is more of a centrist-type candidate, and conservatives and even independents who lean conservative, I think, truthfully, will have some difficulty voting for a person like Sanders. But the second point that I would like to address is, so you have both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. It's interesting to note, they directly attack Bernie Sanders. You don't see Sanders directly attacking Hillary Clinton. He attacks issues that she identifies with, but he does not attack the person. And I guess it's also interesting to see Madeleine Albright come out and make these statements that she has made when what did she do when she was ambassador to the UN? She stated that the 500,000 or so Iraqi children that died as collateral damage, and that she justified her refusal to allow, I guess it's chlorine in for the water. And so I don't find that humanist type concern either on the part of Hillary or on her for her supporters. They are supporting her, but they are not supporting humanist or socialist principles.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Let's start with this difference, though. I think there is a difference between being a democratic socialist and a socialist, and I know that Bernie will be portrayed, should he become the candidate, I don't know if he will or not, the nominee, that he will be portrayed as a socialist because people have a negative view of socialism in this country. But there is a difference. It's not that he believes that the government should be in charge of everything. I think we should make that difference somewhat clear at the beginning here. Ruth?
Well, you know, the Cold War is over, And, you know, I was at a, you know, I listened to Donald Trump say that he couldn't wait to run against Bernie Sanders if he were the nominee because he'd love to see a communist run for president in this country. So there's a lot of Red Scare language that attaches to the word socialism. But the truth is, Sanders has gone a long way. I mean, one of the chief accomplishments of his campaign, he's gone a long way towards getting people to actually look at what the definition of socialism is. Mm-hmm. And he did this for a long time in Vermont as a member of Congress there, talking to conservative Vermont farmers and saying, look, this is what I believe. And it sort of destroyed that negative impact of the label, because the truth is people fundamentally agreed with what he was proposing, and they thought, yeah, why shouldn't we take up these issues again and say, shouldn't we have national health insurance? Shouldn't we have an access to a college education for everybody? And, you know, so people agreed with it. I think that the sort of Cold War McCarthyite attachment to that label is shredding and declining, because you have a whole generation of people now who are voting who grew up after Reagan. It's really not, we're not living in the same country that we were before.
Thanks, Michael, so much for your call. Let's go to Timothy in Prairie Farms. Hi, Timothy.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for your program, and I just had the privilege of driving down a week ago to Iowa. I have friends down there who used to live there, and observe the caucus firsthand. And I hear you saying, and some others, and to me I think it's unclear, that Hillary just won by a slight margin. Am I misunderstanding things? They each get the delegates that they had, of those who voted for them. So they split the votes. I mean, they split the number of delegates that they had. Isn't that the correct way of putting it, instead of saying Hillary won? I mean,
it's not
the issue.
I thought she got a couple more than he did, didn't she, Ruth?
I think she got a couple more delegates than he did. It's possible that he won the popular vote. There were a lot of new voters. But it's you know, basically it's a tie. And I think the significance out of Iowa is that it's a tie.
She gets hers, and he gets his.
Mm-hmm. So, that's right.
So why call it a win? It's a matter of they split the delegates.
I think she has two more than he does, so that's why they're calling it a win.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Timothy. Is that going to be investigated? I know there were some questions. The Des Moines Register was very upset and called for there to be an investigation of this.
Well, you remember Rick Santorum was robbed in Iowa, and you know Mitt Romney was declared the winner, and 3 weeks later they finally recounted and decided that it was in fact Rick Santorum, and at that point it did him no good at all. I don't think we're going to see that here. You know, it was close enough that the difference either way, I think the campaign, the Sanders campaign, it really would be, doesn't see it as worth relitigating. But definitely there were charges that perhaps they miscounted. I mean, I went to the caucus at Happy's Place Bar in Dubuque and watched how they did it there. And it is a very interesting kind of local democracy operation. And because they don't report the number of votes, they only report the number of delegates that are derived from the number of votes, there's room for error, and there's room for going back and looking again at how it was counted. But, you know, yes, you're right. AP did a story saying basically they looked at it again and they thought that it was accurate. There continue to be questions out of some of the polling places. I don't think that we're going to see that develop into a bigger story. I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Connie on Facebook said there's some really terrible stuff on social media from young male supporters for Bernie against young female supporters for Hillary. Also, Albright's comment is something she said for years to encourage women to support women in general, an extremely important issue, not fully appreciated.
I think that's true, and I see a lot of feminist writers who I like, including Claire Jeffrey at Mother Jones and Kathy Pollitt at The Nation and others, pointing out the sexist comments from Bernie Sanders supporters, and particularly the aversion to Hillary Clinton, some of which is absolutely rooted in dislike of her as a woman. I mean, I think that's undeniable that there's a sexist tint to the dislike of Hillary, and has been, frankly, since she first emerged as a, you know, when her husband was running for president. And I remember seeing T-shirts at the 92 Democratic convention, or rather the Republican convention, saying, ditch the bitch, ditch the witch. You know, there was this just tremendous dislike of the Clintons as a couple that had two professional lawyers in it, and her kind of breaking the mold of the housewifely first lady. And I think there's a lot of that in the air. And so I don't blame people for feeling defensive of her. And I agree that a lot of the criticism of her is sexist. But I also think that there's legitimate criticism of her policy positions, and also that her message is out of tune with where young people are this year, where voters are in the post-Occupy, post-financial market crash America. And that when you hear Hillary's surrogates argue that we can't, that it's unrealistic and foolish to have this more aspirational progressive politics that Bernie Sanders represents to people, you know, there's a backlash against that. And it's, I think it's really deaf to what's going on, you know, just at the very grassroots level. So I think both of those things are legitimate things to talk about.
Chris in Wisconsin Dells, hi.
Hi. I'm regrettably part of that older demographic that's for Bernie Sanders, the female demographic that's for Bernie Sanders. I called his office 2 years ago, his Senate office in Washington, D.C., and encouraged him to run for president. I'm not going to go into the various Hillary reasons for that, but I think that Bernie Sanders, I would like to encourage older women to take a look at this, at the situation, because I would be willing to bet that Bernie Sanders is thinking long and hard about who to put on the ticket as a vice presidential candidate, and then he's looking at a bunch of women. Now, from what I understand, Elizabeth Warren doesn't want it, but there is this fabulous U.S. representative from Los Angeles, California, named Loretta Sanchez, that would make a great vice presidential candidate, and then he can take the heat off from the Hispanic candidates on the Republican side.
Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I don't know, you know, who the VP list is. But what I do know, which I think is very interesting about the Sanders campaign, is that for lack of staff and money early on at the state level, and especially in the western and southwestern states, the Sanders campaign kind of turned its operations over to movement groups and Dreamers in particular, young, active labor organizers who introduced Sanders, who organized house parties for him, and who really influenced the campaign and have had a lot to do with what its message is. So in that way, I think the Sanders campaign, because it's kind of this guerrilla operation, because it didn't have a lot of money and it certainly didn't have a lot of organization in all the states, has become a vehicle for movement politics and has, for people who really care about immigration issues, I think view his immigration policies as more progressive than Hillary Clinton's. And also just that he has those activists really forming the campaign, becoming the campaign at the state level. And I think what's significant about that is that after the Sanders campaign is over, whatever the result is, there could be an organization sort of like what the Obama organization promised to become but didn't, the Organize for America, which became a vehicle for the National Democratic Party, that's actually an activist organization informed by these various progressive groups that puts pressure on Washington to take more progressive policy positions. And that would be a very significant contribution to American politics.
I'm sure you saw Craig Gilbert's front page article in the Journal Sentinel yesterday that said, come time for the primary here in the state of Wisconsin, all you have to do is take a good look, at least at this moment, what's happening in Madison, what the vote might be in Milwaukee, to look at the uphill battle perhaps that Sanders will face, that Hillary Clinton has a 90% approval rating among African Americans in Milwaukee. Her ad money will be going to this city, whereas Bernie Sanders has this huge approval rating in Madison. His ad money will be going into Madison.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a struggle for the Sanders campaign, is attracting African-American voters. And absolutely, Hillary Clinton has a much bigger margin of support among African-Americans. And I think some of that has to do with defending the Obama legacy, that Hillary Clinton is seen as the person who's defending the Affordable Care Act, who is carrying forward the Obama legacy. And so much of the backlash that Obama has faced is racially motivated. And I think there's a feeling of defending that legacy that she's really tapped into. She also has institutional support because the Clintons have long standing ties to black elected officials in places like South Carolina, where, you know, that's really crucial for getting out the vote. And then, you know, Black Lives Matter protested Sanders early on. Mm-hmm. And his response to that was to admit that he needed to do more to speak specifically to racial justice issues and to really try to make an effort to organize on that front. And I think that's, you know, really what has to happen in the progressive movement is to bring together the economic justice folks and the Black Lives Matter folks. And, you know, again, I think that is a constructive, ongoing thing that's coming out of the Sanders campaign, whether or not it helps him in 2016.
Greg on Facebook asks, how would Bernie implement all his policies with a Republican House? I don't see that changing in 2016. Wouldn't it be the same situation that Obama faced?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's true of any Democratic president, though. And I think there's a really conflicting set of messages about Hillary Clinton as the person who can get things done with the Republican Congress. Because on the one hand, we talk about how unfair the bashing of Hillary Clinton has been by the Republicans, because it is, you know, Obama-like in the intensity of hatred and the focus on the Benghazi hearings, on the emails question, you know, on all of these things, lifelong animosity towards Hillary Clinton. She's a great fundraising direct mail campaign face for Republican politicians. So on the one hand, we're saying she's this incredibly polarizing figure and the Republicans hate her. And on the other hand, we're saying she can work with Republicans to get stuff done. I'm not sure that both of those things can be true. So I think any Democratic president is going to have to deal with the Congress that they're dealt and that's going to be a real challenge. And, you know, I don't see that as a liability specifically for Bernie Sanders as opposed to Hillary Clinton.
Claire in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Claire.
Hello.
Something I've noticed, and it's really bugging me, Bernie Sanders, the media almost always mentions the 74-year-old Bernie Sanders. And it really bugs me because he's only about 3 years older than Donald Trump. Minus the $1,000 haircut and possibly a little nip and tuck here and there. And, you know, I mean, I actually heard someone on BBC last night, because I'm an insomniac, refer to him as old. And it's really crazy when he's, like I say, only about 3 years older than Donald Trump. And I think he's getting a bad rap on this.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Trump, I don't know how Trump manages to do what he does. He's got that blonde hair. He's got the permatan. You know, I think maybe the reason people bring it up with Bernie Sanders so much is because he doesn't have any of that polished image, and sort of part of what you get with him is the Larry David impersonation, right? It's just the idea of this guy who's completely unpolished and doesn't care, and his wild white hair is waving around. And people love it, you know?
Well, he's in pretty good shape. He would be the oldest president, it's my understanding. Am I right about that?
I don't know. I can't fact check you instantly on that one. But yeah, I mean, he's 74 is not young for running for president of the United States.
Right. When you think about what these people go through, but a lot of the people aren't very young. Hillary's not all that young.
Right.
Bernie, Trump is not all that young. There are quite a few of them who aren't
Well,
very
it
young.
Says something about the Democratic Party, actually, that the two candidates for president, you know, now that Martin O'Malley is out, are really pretty old, and that we don't have a deep bench of Gen Xers. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have a Marco Rubio. You know, we don't have, you know, and I think that you notice that in Wisconsin politics, and you notice it in national politics, that there is a deficit in the Democratic Party when it comes to having a bench of prospective candidates who are young and moving up.
Well, why is that, Ruth?
You know, I just think that the Democratic Party and also just the sort of progressive organization in the country is way behind the Republican Party in investing in candidate development, in recruiting people, in understanding that down ballot races are important, and that there is a sense of a very long game in feeding that pipeline and bringing people along. I think you don't see that in the Democratic Party the way you do in the Republican Party, which started taking over school boards right under Newt Gingrich. I mean, there's been a very long-term strategy on the Republican side that has not existed on the Democratic side.
You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and Ruth Conniff is our guest, editor-in-chief at the Progressive Magazine. Our phone number, one line is open for you right now, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ruth Conniff is here now, editor-in-chief of The Progressive, and let's go to Chris in Middleton next. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon. The Sorry to talk more about just the Democratic race, but I agree with just about all the criticism of Hillary Clinton, and I like just about everything I hear from Bernie Sanders. But I may end up holding my nose and voting for Ms. Clinton because all the time that Bernie Sanders spent out of Vermont in the Senate, he didn't leave any footprints. He was sort of a Senate non-entity, and I think we've really hurt ourselves by not demanding more experience from our candidates. So, like I say, I think I may end up opting for somebody who seems to know her way around versus somebody who doesn't.
All right, Chris, thanks so much. Ruth.
Well, I think there's no doubt that Hillary Clinton has a greater breadth of experience than any other candidate running for president, and that, you know, she is, you know, certainly more than amply qualified to be president of the United States, and that her foreign policy experience in particular hugely overshadows Bernie Sanders. You know, whether or not you agree with that, she's been a hawk in the Obama administration is another question. And then, you know, on the Sanders side, I don't know that I would say that he's gotten nothing done in the Senate. I think as head of the Veterans Committee in the Senate, he has done a lot to try to improve health care for veterans. He's done a lot to, you know, champion veterans. And I think the veterans organizations feel that he's been a really effective champion for their interests. You know, I think he's been an important voice in the Senate for progressive policy positions. And I'm not sure that it's really fair to say that I don't think that he's been a show horse. I don't think that he's been there to pretend to do things in order to run a future presidential campaign. I think the presidential campaign came as a bit of a surprise, actually, and that he's been really involved in progressive policy issues and also reaching across the aisle where he can, especially on things like the Veterans Affairs Commission. So, you know, I think that it's probably unfair to say that he's ineffective or out of it or not serving the people of Vermont, but there's no doubt that Hillary Clinton is enormously qualified.
Thanks so much for the call. We go next to Fawn in Madison. Hi, Fawn.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And having this discussion. I've been a feminist ever since I ever heard of the concept as a little girl in the 1970s. I've been yearning and waiting and hoping for a female president for a very long time. I would love to see that come along and to happen. However, I think it's just as sexist to vote for a woman for president solely because she's a woman or primarily because she's a woman, just as sexist as it is to oppose a candidate solely because she's a woman or primarily because she's a woman. I think she has to have the platform, and it would be patronizing to overlook her platform and her policies in favor of her gender. I really strongly agree with Bernie Sanders' platform and his campaign, and I am for Bernie Sanders. I think he'll do so much good in the White House for women, families, and children and men. And I think that women will come out ahead with Bernie Sanders as the leader. So that's how I feel, and I'm just still waiting for the candidate to come along. If it were the case that we needed just a woman as our figurehead, we would do with a Michelle Bachmann, God forbid, or Carly Fiorina, or, you know, for that matter, Sarah Palin. But that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for the real progressive leader who can do all that and also galvanize us.
And who is that for you now, Fawn?
Well, you know, Elizabeth Warren, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I would just love to see her up there, but I understand it's not her, you know, her role right now.
Thank you so much. Why didn't she run this go-around, Ruth? Do you know?
Well, there was a lot of pressure on her to run. I don't know that she felt like that was a good role for her. I mean, she has very specific policy expertise, and, you know, she's playing a very specific role in the Senate, and I'm not sure she wanted to make the leap to, you know, when our last caller was talking about, are you qualified? Do you have depth of experience on things like foreign policy matters? I mean, we have no idea what Elizabeth Warren's foreign policy positions are. So, you know, she represents something. She represents a movement in this country. And I hear, you know, what Fawn was saying, I hear a lot from younger women who really are big fans of Elizabeth Warren and men as well. I mean, she represents this idea that we've got to rein in the banks, that, you know, that the system is rigged. And that's really important. But it is It is one policy area. It's not a whole array of policy positions.
You wrote, Ruth, that she, Hillary, that is closely associated with her husband's administration and its centrist policies, welfare reform, bank deregulation, the corporate trade deals, the assertion that the era of big government is over. She's changed some of her policy positions now. Is she still associated and should be still associated with her husband's centrist administration?
Well, I think she's on the record, you know, defending some of those positions. And she's not, you know, it was the Clinton administration that repealed Glass-Steagall. So that was the beginning of the bank deregulation that contributed to the crash. Hillary Clinton does not want to restore it. You know, she was an outspoken proponent of NAFTA. She's now moderated her positions on trade. And she actually did that in the last presidential campaign. She moved to the left during the campaign across the upper Midwest where, you know, NAFTA has taken a real toll on jobs and manufacturing. But if you listen to her in the debate, pro-death penalty, still pro many free trade agreements, and she had a shout-out for Henry Kissinger, of all people, for saying that she ran a tight ship at the State Department. So there is a very, and furthermore, kind of the overarching message of her campaign, that she's a progressive who gets things done, that she's the more sensible choice, that she's an incrementalist, basically. I think that is very much echoing the Clinton administration triangulation, you know, go for the swing voters, do a little bit, compromise with the Republicans, you know, approach to politics. And her surrogates and her defenders talk a lot about how we need to be concerned about conservative voters, swing voters, and that whole approach, that less progressive approach to politics, the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, the theory that we needed to stop caring what unions think, we need to, you know, be more conservative socially, we need to be tough on crime, tough on welfare, cut government, all of that, that whole message out of the 90s, you know, is not where people are now. I think that's why you see this huge groundswell for a message that says, hey, we're going to call ourselves socialist, and we're going to open this question of whether big government might be good for people and whether tax cuts for the wealthy and deregulation have actually not been disastrous for most Americans. Mm-hmm.
I remember interviewing Robert Reich years ago, shortly after he left the Clinton administration as Secretary of Labor, and he said, and he's a big Sanders supporter now, as you know, that the only thing the Clinton administration gave us was the V-chip.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he struggled within that administration as a progressive voice, and it was very discouraging for him. And I think the rest of the country has moved to where he is to say, yeah, the inequality has just exploded, and there are no protections for people. And you know, that tough on crime policy led directly to mass incarceration, that the death penalty, it turns out we've been executing innocent people, and it's inhumane. I mean, you know, the world has changed. And I think that the Democratic Party and people who care, who are inclined to vote Democratic, and people who don't vote and ought to be voting Democratic, you know, have moved in a more progressive direction. And that's, you know, that's the tide. And Hillary Clinton is a little bit behind that tide.
Mm-hmm. Fawn, thank you. Judy and Racine, hi.
Hi, Elizabeth Warren again. Do you think she'll come out at some point in support of Bernie Sanders?
She hasn't endorsed, and I don't know that she will. She's the only woman in Congress who has not come out for Hillary. So, I mean, or in the Senate, you know.
Is she?
That's very interesting. She's the only one who has withheld her support. And you know, Hillary Clinton was a senator from Wall Street. So, you know, I don't think Elizabeth Warren is going to rush to throw her endorsement behind her. She may if she's the nominee. I think she'll be careful.
And what about President Obama? Will he be forced to endorse her?
I think President Obama is going to give her some support. I do. I think, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, it was interesting to see Joe Biden speak so highly of Bernie Sanders, and I think quite a blow to Hillary Clinton, actually. And I think, you know, they're being careful. And also there's a calculation about how much it helps the next candidate for the president to come out strongly for one or the other. But, yeah, I suspect that Obama is going to do more to help Hillary.
And finally, Melody on Facebook says, I will vote for the Democrat, but I'll also vote in the midterms. When the millennials find that not all their dreams are fulfilled in 4 years, will they vote? Because they sure didn't in Wisconsin, and look what we have.
Yeah, it's true. Younger voters are notoriously unreliable. And it takes more than one election to get things done. And I think that the significance of the Sanders campaign that has so excited millennials is not the short term, but the longer term. And so a lot of that will depend on whether, in fact, there is this organization that comes out of that campaign. And that's what interests me. It's not what's going to be talked about this year, but that's the long term prospect.
Mm-hmm. Ruth, thank you so much. You're a great guest. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, wonderful to be with you, Kathleen.
Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine, and she's written extensively about, of course, the presidential election. Tomorrow during this time, James Fallows will be joining us. He'll talk about his most recent piece in The Atlantic that looks at civic engagement in America. So that's tomorrow during this time period. And please join us for our tribute to Bob Elliott of Bob and Ray, the kind of humor that was never cruel and lasted for so many years and was so inventive. And he was such a kind and humble man. We just loved his comedy, so we'll pay tribute to Bob Elliott. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Kendra Smith for their on-air production, and to Scotty Myers.